Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Air with Dr. Pat Allen, Empowered Communication, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in with us tonight. I want to start off with a little bit of business and say thank you once again to the One Institute for sponsoring our show On the Air with Dr. Pat Allen, Empowered Communications. Tonight we have a very, very special guest with us, and we are going to be talking about suicide prevention, and depression. So I want to welcome Dr. Allen, as always, and Robert Storr. Robert, talk to us. Tell us a little bit about where you are, what you do, and why.
Sure. Good evening, Kelly. And good evening to all our listeners out there. My name is Robert Storr, and I'm the director of the Suicide Prevention Center, and we cover all of Los Angeles, Orange County, Riverside, San Bernardino. And we have a 24-hour, 7-days-a-week crisis line that's in Spanish and English. So that's our main mission. Why I'm there and why I'm here is I'm also a survivor of a suicide loss. So my background is a clinician. I'm a licensed marriage, family, child therapist. But having lost a significant other to suicide was what caused me to transition out of my career in administration of a hospital into suicide prevention.
Wow, that is amazing. So you went from being a hospital administrator, basically running a hospital, to running the center for prevention, losing a significant other, a partner, has got to be insane. As you know, you and I have discussed, I lost my nephew, Patrick Barrow, and my very best friend of 45 years, William Johnston. Both of them, to suicide. My nephew was a self-harmer. He was somebody who cut themselves and burnt themselves. And while we did see it as a sign that there were problems, and we repeatedly took him to doctors, they would say really bald things like, well, he's acting like a teenage girl, and this is normal. And I never thought it was normal. Do you run into that?
Yes, we run into it quite a bit. I think because of the stigma surrounding suicide, suicide prevention is just now starting to become something that a lot of people are beginning to talk about. I mean, we're going to lose over 40,000 people to suicide, enough to fill a stadium. It's the 10th leading cause of death for adults. It's the second leading cause now for teenagers. Yet we don't talk about it in the schools. We don't train our physicians to become aware of what the warning signs are or the risk factors. We don't even train our therapists, like myself, in most cases, to really recognize not only what the warning signs are, but how to respond and talk about suicide to individuals that are at risk. Because of that, people that are suffering from suicidal ideation or thinking about suicide or having had maybe a previous attempt often don't seek the treatment that they need. And so there's a great amount of education needed and a great amount of awareness that we're trying to raise. We do our best to not only work with people in crisis, but to destigmatize suicide and to make clinicians, physicians, and us, so thank you for talking about it tonight, comfortable talking about it, because when we do that, we allow the people that we love and care about who are in danger of harming or killing themselves the opportunity to come to us and seek the help that they need. But most of them don't, and that's why many of us who are survivors are left stunned, shocked, not knowing what to do, wondering what we could have done. And in some cases, there are things we could have done had we been taught or educated. Most people who die by suicide will have seen their primary care physician within the last 90 days, and that primary care physician will have missed the signs that that person was suicidal often, and most often then that person will make an attempt or die. There will be over 5,000 attempts in Los Angeles and about 800, 900 deaths this year. So we still have a very significant problem here.
It's very concerning to me because I hate to use this term, but I don't know what else to do. When I caught my nephew, in other words, I discovered the cut marks on his body. And I was shocked. And I said to him, my goodness gracious, what is that? Let me see that. And then he tried to hide it. And then I said, did you do that? And this was a long time ago. And my goodness gracious, this was a really long time ago. 15 years, 16 years ago. I didn't understand it. And nobody talked about it. And like I said, we took him to the doctor and they said, oh, this is something a teenage girl does to get attention. You know, he's seeking attention. Yeah, he was seeking attention. He was seeking help. But they weren't looking at it like that. It was something to be ashamed of. And I notice that there's a lot of shame attached to that. And I know they're saying that self-harm isn't necessarily a precursor to suicide, but I do think it's one of the red flags that we have to look at.
It is an identified risk factor. And then again, that is about educating people, because some of the myths that are out there are that someone who talks about suicide will not actually take their life by suicide. And that's incorrect. People who talk about suicide should be taken very seriously, because what we call warning signs, we like to rename invitations. People who die by suicide 4 out of 5 times want the help and they want us to know. They're not really seeking to die. They're seeking to get out of the psychic pain they're there. And you're very, very, very correct that your nephew was looking for help and the physician missed it. And we weren't educated because of the stigma to know that that can be an identified risk factor. And if that individual didn't get some sort of a protective factor like treatment or family support or some ongoing counseling or therapy or medication management, if he was suffering from depression, then he went on suffering. And cutting, there is such a thing as non-suicidal injury, which means he might have been cutting to relieve the pain and translate that emotion into his body. But once someone does cross that barrier, that can also now become a risk factor for a potential suicide, as you now know, down the road.
He did tell me when we sat down and he did finally talk to me about it, he said, there's a monster inside of me, and the only way that I can get the monster out is by cutting myself. And the monster is pain. And unfortunately, as hard as my sister and myself and the entire family rallied around to try to help him, I just don't know what happens. If they reach a point where things are just, they just don't see any hope, if that's what it is. I mean, I question that.
Well, there's several constructs that we now look at that are precursors to suicide, and hopelessness and helplessness are two of them. If an individual gets to a point in their life where they can't figure out whatever the solution is to the problem, and relationship, financial problems for teenagers, belonging or feeling part of, not feeling isolated, alone, not feeling abnormal, not being able to express their feelings, if they reach a place where they can't do that, they will often look for the opportunity to somehow signal somebody that they need the help. But there are ways that we can address that if we're tuning in and recognizing what's going on with them. But again, we're not often tuned into what the warning signs are. And your nephew, like when he was saying, there's a monster inside, he was saying, I want help. I need help. We know that people who die by suicide, again, aren't usually wanting to die. They're wanting to get out of the pain that he was expressing.
And he did say that he wanted to get out of the pain. He wanted to get away from the pain, and inflicting the pain was a way to get away from it. And we took him to therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and everybody. And ironically, many times he would lock down. He would not communicate. And later on, right before he did what he did, he had a problem with addiction and had just come out of a rehab. The very next day, he killed himself. So, Dr. Allen, you are an addiction specialist. And what correlation do you see between addiction and suicide and addiction and self-harm?
Any addiction comes in two styles. One is genetic, and it's biochemical, neurobiochemical, and that is basically a physical illness. They're either schizophrenic or schizotypical, or they're clinically depressed or they're bipolar. And that requires really expert medical attention. Do you see?
Yes.
And so the other form of suicide I would call spiritual. It's,
okay.
You have to have someone to love and love you. You have to have something to do in life that feels worthy. And you have to have something to look forward to. Those are the three needs of human beings. So in our day and age today, as families disintegrate, cultures disintegrate, we become addicted to our computers and our friendly, what do they call that?
Smartphone.
Social media. We're getting to the place where highly sensitive people, and I refer you to the book, The Indigo Child,
mm-hmm.
and I refer you to Elaine, what is her name? Highly sensitive people, Aaron's.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are temperamentally so spiritually thin-skinned that if they don't have support, they don't thrive. It's the same as Dr. Spitz found out in the depression.
Right.
He did the research on why did babies die, newborns die, when they were put on the steps of orphanages.
Right.
Because the doctors and the nurses fed them, housed them, you know, did everything. Well, the problem is the spiritual problem. When I say spiritual, I mean that ethereal system that allows us to love and be loved.
Right.
Do you see?
Yeah.
That if you didn't get it, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
In starting in the first 3 days of life, you could commit suicide physically as an infant by not thriving.
Right, but basically,
even though they had done things. And
or
then,
in other words, feeding and watering is, you know, even have to talk to your plants. So that terrified me. That terrified me as a young mother. I became a mother at 17. And I had read an article that T. Barry Brazelton had written about children who did not get their spines stroked.
Yes.
That they suffered all kinds of emotional and physical handicaps. And
right.
So it was a ritual for me at 17 because, you know, they don't come with a manual. And I was just barely a kid myself.
Right.
But I made it a practice with all of my children to touch them, to pet them, to, you know, brush their hair and stroke their spine and these things.
Do you know the two spots on the human body that are most sensitive to humanization? Because we're born animals.
Feet. I think the feet might be one.
Feet.
Isn't that crazy?
Feet. And the mouth.
And the mouth, right.
The mouth. So I appreciate what you're saying about the spine, but I like Ashley Montague's Touching,
oh, yeah.
Third edition.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be touched. But in today's world where we're going into cyberspace all the time, I'm afraid that we really are losing our skills at spiritually loving each other.
I think that's interesting. And I think that what else is interesting about that is that we have a lot of young people, teenagers right now, being cyberbullied, and they take it extremely seriously to the point where some of them have actually committed suicide. I know we have one
right.
little girl that caught herself on fire. Another little girl threw herself off of a water tower because somebody said something horribly, horribly, horribly emotionally disfiguring to
mm-hmm.
these children, these teens. And they actually took their own life because of it. On the other side of that spectrum, you're not finding that same emotional stroking in a positive way through that same medium. And I want to know why that is. What is it that makes the negative so strong and the positive almost non-existent?
Mm-hmm.
We have a call. Let's see what they have to say. Thank you, caller. You are on the air with Dr. Allen and Dr. Storr.
Hi. Would it be okay to ask Dr. Allen a question?
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to ask her. I wanted to change the subject. I have some friends who are single mothers, and they have sons, and they are afraid that they are over-mothering their sons. And what are some typical ways that a single mother would over-mother their son? And how can she stop doing that? And how can she get good male? How can the sons get good male role models?
Well, first of all, I want to quote the Upanishads of East India. Beware of your thoughts, for they become words. Beware of your words, they become habits. Beware of your habits, they become your character. Beware of your character, it becomes your destiny. In school and banks and doctor's offices and in every single relationship. So, under the age of 5, children need to be cherished. Do you see? Their feelings mm-hmm. cared for. But starting at 5 to about 10, there becomes a division. Little boys need to begin the practice of respectability. And they mm-hmm. especially need respect from their mothers. Father is a role model for the little boy, and mother is a mirror to his manhood. So when mothers over-cherish or under-cherish, there are mothers that don't really like being mothers, and they under-cherish. They expect their sons to take care of themselves. So it can go either way, over or under. In that kind of a mother between 5 and 10 is going to end up with the child with a misshapen sense of identity. And the worst one is the kind of child that is basically, what do they call it? Borderline personality disorders. These are people with personality disorders that can't let them negotiate. We all need to negotiate rather than intimidate with fear or seduce with guilt. So a mother of a child, a son, who's 5 to 10, it behooves her to negotiate with him, not intimidate him with bossiness, and not seduce him with over-cherishing, because that's not negotiating. You're treating him like a little dog, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And after 10, from 10 on to 18, Dan Siegel has come up with a great book about the lack of dopamine in teenagers from 13 to 18, and then extending, hopefully they get better by about 25, that nature has designed them to lower their dopamine so that they leave the nest to go find dopamine fun outside of home. And of course, what do? They do it. They ride motorcycles, they drive fast, they start playing with drugs, whatever. But they start exploring that kind of lifestyle that will bring them the dopamine that is what nature wants them to have when they get to the childbearing, birthing age. And whether we like it or not, the only reason children don't marry at 13 to 18 is they can't afford it in a culture that costs money. And so they're stuck at home. And basically, then the mother, who, if she breaks his spirit, you see, one of the worst things that can happen between a mother of a 10 to 18-year-old, one of the worst things she can do is to become the respected authority figure. Father is a role model, of a man or the lack of a role model. He's either gone or he's not a man either. He's a little boy man, and mother is the better man. So a mother of a teenager has got to realize that she must treat this young man like a young man. And, son, you have a right to want to do that, but I'm uncomfortable, and I'm not going to allow it because my job is to see that you are a good citizen when you leave home. So if you do that action to get your dopamine up, it's going to cost you some form of freedom, some form of special care. I've had a mother have her 10-year-old arrested for throwing things at her, and that was to get a probation officer for him because his father was alcoholic and could not and would not represent. This is one of the reasons that sports are so good for little boys. Boy Scouts is good for little boys. Because in those sports and in those activities, they develop kinship, which is people to love, something to do, and something to look forward to. Another thing I want to say is the statistics for the safety of the mind, body, and spirit of children is highly improved by attendance at a church. Churches can benefit children by giving them the idea of character, ethics, morality, and the spiritual element of goodness. So these are the things. Respect is what a boy needs. And for girls, girls need to be cherished by the men in their life. Daddy, come on, honey, stop crying. You're as good as a little boy is not the phrase. Is it, come on, honey, I know you're upset. You and I can talk about it, and I'll help you feel better. Mothers help sons do better to feel better. Fathers help daughters feel better to do better.
Well, I think in two situations, there are mothers who are over-mothering the sons in that they're, like, very nurturing after 10 years old, and they don't understand the line between being over-nurturing and letting them go and not letting them be too enmeshed in their lives.
Well, that's what we would call mama's boys. But when mamas do the Oedipal complex, which is an inappropriate emotional attachment to a son, or a father does an Electra complex, an inappropriate connection with his daughter, those people have solved their problem. They are, in fact, in control. The secret is, you know what, Hillary Clinton wrote the book, It Takes a Village to Raise a Child. You must seek help somewhere, whether it's coaches, you know, whether it's Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, churches, someplace where people get together in order to give children a sense of belonging to a lovable culture. You see?
So the mom should bring the boy to those places.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you, caller. Okay. So, speaking of dopamine, that's a question I have with respect to alcohol, drug addiction, and suicide. Is it a precursor? Is it an enabler? Alcohol and drugs? And is one worse than the other?
I can talk a little bit about, just in terms of addiction in relationship to suicide. Alcohol is recognized in a lot of deaths by suicide, and often we believe there are comorbid situations where there's a psychological issue and an addiction issue. Mm-hmm. And it is theorized, and I think Dr. Allen agrees with this as well, that a lot of people are using a substance to treat the lack of dopamine or serotonin as a soothing mechanism or a stimulant if they're not having enough dopamine. So it is a short-term substitute, which unfortunately, as it's introduced, has to be reintroduced in larger amounts, obviously, for someone who's doing that to get the same impact, which ultimately means it doesn't resolve the issue. And that's why I think we're pretty conscious that an addiction with a chemical problem, and I think, again, Dr. Allen said this about the idea that treating somebody with medication management is really significant. Now, we know that 1 out of 10 people that die by suicide, and we try not to use the word committed because what do people commit? They commit crimes.
Right.
So we usually say die by suicide. The 1 out of 10 had a depression or a mental health issue, but only 1 out of 10,000 people who have depression actually die by suicide. So many people have depression and we're not worried that they're actually in danger of killing themselves. However, when you talk about some of the other risk factors, like dealing with a substance abuse, having a family history, dealing with somebody who's already in a very had child trauma or lack of mothering and parenting, now you're introducing significant risk factors that up the ante, that could be a potential precursor for suicide. So medication management, absolutely, and treatment. The last risk factor that we know is if you know someone in your life who's had a previous suicide attempt, that's the one known risk factor. We know that 37% of those people will go on to die by suicide with a second attempt. Now, a great many of people who make an attempt will not end up dying. But if someone has that in your history and you're a physician, a family member, a clinician, mm-hmm. and that comes up in a history, a discussion, a conversation, and you know that, that's an immediate risk factor that elevates all of those other risk factors. So if you up the ante with, okay, I have a chemical addiction, someone who's suffering from depression, maybe engaging in self-injury and a substance abuse, and has a previous attempt, they've now crossed over into that category that we really want to be concerned if they enter a highly stressful situation. And then hopefully we'll be able to recognize the warning signs and talk to them about it.
Now, Dr. Allen was saying that extremely low dopamine in teens, and would we attribute that to the high suicide rate among teenagers? Would that be a factor that we're looking at with respect to that?
If they don't have surroundings, if they're required to raise themselves, we're social animals.
Right.
And our kids need us, and we're becoming too individualized with our connections, with our social media and all that. It will become bad enough that we will realize what we're doing, because that's the way problems are solved. It gets so bad that people have to pay attention.
And I think, you know, she's absolutely right. So we have the biochemical issue, and it's kind of like the chicken and the egg, which happened first. Are we raising kids who are now prone to be biochemically deficient, or are we losing the process of families and social support? Well, we don't know about the first, but we definitely know the latter is happening. Absolutely, people are disconnecting from families and isolating through social media, the internet, texting, emailing. And without that social connection, absolutely, perceived burdensome and social isolation and exposure to violence are three main factors in combination that will predispose somebody to suicide. And without what we call the protective factors, there are protective factors. So if you are suffering from a depression or a biochemical issue, yet you are grounded with a family that's there for you and they're connecting with you and you're somehow integrated in school, those can begin to mitigate some of those other responsibilities that are happening outside that aren't connecting to you. And actually, that's what we work for. We work for getting somebody into medical management, social support, and connection. And if they can do that, and therapeutic intervention, then, and we know the risk factors are there, you can mitigate that and potentially save people's lives. So absolutely.
So now, what about when you get in a situation with somebody where you suspect that they're self-medicating? And by that I mean using alcohol or whatever drugs, what what
sugar.
Yeah, to self-medicate. My example will be my mother, who at 23 years old had her very first panic attack. She had panic disorder, but of course I didn't know anything in that back then. Okay, that was like 1962, 63. She went to the doctor. They said, "You're crazy. You need to be put into an institution because you're nuts." And they had no solution for her. So my mother, at 23, began self-medicating through wine. My mother drank wine. She had panic disorder, and the only way for her to be able to stop a panic attack was to take a belt. And that's what she did. And they didn't have doctors that were you know, looking at things like Xanax and Valium and other, you know.
We didn't have antidepressants 40, 50 years ago.
Right. So she did that. She self-medicated. Unfortunately, in the advent of these wonderful drugs that they've created to help people with that problem, she had already become agoraphobic. She was terrified of leaving the house. She would not step out of the door if it wasn't with me or my father or something like that. So she never really got help from the medical community. So she just continued that until she finally, of course, as you may guess, ended up with cirrhosis and congestive heart failure. And I know alcoholism runs in families. And yes, it's ironic. Yes. I'm like, I don't drink almost at all. Just like, oh, I'll have a glass of wine with dinner once every 3, 4, 5 months. But when I really look at my mother, I don't know that she was really an alcoholic by choice. I think that she had such a factor with the anxiety. And ironically, she did have, I think, from time to time, suicidal ideation where she would say, "I just don't want to do this anymore. I just don't want to do this anymore." And I would say, "I don't understand what that means." And she would say, "I don't want to be dead. I just don't want to do this anymore." And I shared with you earlier that I didn't understand that. And I have a really hard time because I always see, like, oh, was it a little glimmer of light at the corner? You know, and maybe I'm a Pollyanna. I don't know.
Well, you really coined what we know. And the early researchers that founded the Suicide Prevention Center in Los Angeles.
What's the name of it?
The D.D. Hirsch Suicide Prevention Center in Los
Angeles.
Director. Exactly.
And do you have a number?
Yes, yeah. For people who are listening or tapping into this, if you do need some help, there is an 800 number that is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And the Lifeline is tied in to over 160 crisis centers throughout the United States. And the number is 1-800-273-TALK. So it's 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255. And it's worth mentioning that if you are feeling suicidal or have suicidal feelings, have a history of a previous attempt, or if you're a family member like you are that are concerned about somebody who's having suicidal thoughts or has said they want to die, or you have a teenager that has depression or an issue like self-injury, you can call that number and it will route you to a crisis center in your area, and they will take either you or the individual and work with them to either de-escalate the crisis, but also help you understand what it is to look at the warning signs and understand the ambivalence the person's going through and find resources in your community that can help them. So really important that when the Suicide Prevention Center was found here in Los Angeles, it was the first in the United States back in the late 1950s. They were doing researchers, and they were working with the coroner's office, and they came across these suicide prevention notes. They looked at them, and they began to understand that these people were sending out invitations. They did not want to die. They started going through the hospital, the vet center in Brentwood, and the nurses would grab them and say, "Would you talk to this person who survived the tip?" They're like, "We're researchers, not clinicians." But they went in anyway and talked to the person, and that's where they discovered that concept of ambivalence, that people who were saying things like, I don't want to die. I just can't figure out how to live. And I think one of the keystone factors that you mentioned and Dr. Allen did, we go way back over 30 years when we worked together. And one of the first things I learned with her, because she works as a certified chemical addiction specialist as well as a marriage, family, child therapist, was the very thing you're talking about, Kelly, that individuals who were self-medicating, who were suffering from sort of a biochemical issue, were definitely, they were dealing with a biochemical issue. And without doctors knowing, and her state of treatment, which I think was state of the art and still is today, was sending people to a physician to be evaluated so that we stopped looking at that issue as a shame-bound issue that you were weak or didn't have willpower or, you know, just couldn't stop because you didn't have the stamina or whatever.
The best book on that I know, The Craving Brain by Dr. Rudin, and it's noted for, it's not your lack of self-will, it's your craving brain.
Absolutely. And knowing that and helping people understand that, the same thing with suicide and mental health issues. If we can destigmatize that and we can understand that those people that are asking us for help, and you identify that when they say things like, I'm feeling suicidal, I can't go on, or are you seeing a sudden change in behavior, a withdrawal, a conversation about I want to die or I can't do this, ask, are you thinking of killing yourself?
Yeah.
Ask, have you been thinking about suicide? And make it okay for them to talk about it, because again, we're frightened to ask the question because we don't know what to do with the response.
That's true. And you know, I have to tell you honestly, I told you about my dear friend, and he and I were extremely close. We were in constant communication on a daily basis, 10, 15, 20 times a day, text messages, phone calls, Facebook messages, whatever it was. We were always in contact. We were extremely connected. When he took his life, I was completely caught unaware. And yet, I knew that at 8 years old, he had tried to hang himself with a belt. And then he told me another story of him in his 20s where he had a pistol and he was going to do that. And he stopped. And then, like I told you, just 2 weeks ago, he actually did take his life. But I have to be honest with you. I didn't see it. I knew he was going through terrible things. And I was saying things to him like, okay, you know, I know you got laid off, but it's okay because, you know, you're not going to go hungry. And if anything happens, you'll come stay with me and it'll be okay. You know, we'll work through it together. You know, I'm not going to desert you. And let's do your resume together. And we did. He came over. We had dinner, you know. And we did his resume together, and I printed them out for him, and I helped him email them, and he was hopeful, he was excited, and then a couple of other things occurred, and then I woke up, and there was no message from him in the morning. There was always a message from him in the morning, and I thought, he has the kids today, or whatever it was. Even though it was unusual for him not to be in contact with me. And I began calling him and texting him. And I'm like, where are you? What are you doing? Are you with the kids? Just let me know what's going on. So that day. And then the next day I had finals. And I thought, oh, he knows I have finals. He's just letting me do my finals. Because I had three finals on Thursday. And then finally on Friday, I talked about you being on our show tonight, and I left here, and I went to my sister's house, and I said, my heart is so heavy. I'm in just abject terror. I don't know where he is, and this is just not like him. And she said, he hasn't been on Facebook. And I said, no. And she said, something's wrong. So I got in my car, and I began driving, and to find him, and I couldn't. And then I called one hospital that was two blocks from his house. They said, no, he's not here. And I was like, oh. there was just relief. And then I thought, I'm going to call this other hospital. No, no, they would never take him there. That's so far from his house. No, 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 no. Everything's okay. You're just, you know, you're over the top. What's wrong with you? But I did, and he was there. So, but I was completely shocked, totally shocked.
And first of all, I want to tell you, I'm so sorry for your loss, because those of you who are listening and you now are who have survived it and now twice, it's a horrific grief to be left with and a bucket of what ifs to kind of go through to figure out. And I want to be really kind of cautious about what I say, but I also want to be really poignant in terms of you can't always tell and you can't always save somebody's life. And if somebody truly dies by suicide, sometimes, I'm going to say this sometimes, because it's not that it was inevitable, because it's not always inevitable. Sometimes there is nothing you can do. But what we don't do in our culture, and you're introducing the topic tonight, which is brilliant, and I thank you again for that, is we don't understand that you just identified what we now know are known risk factors. So we know if someone has a previous history of a suicide attempt, that right there qualifies them, if they hit a crisis, as a potential death by suicide right off the bat. So we wouldn't know that unless we were talking about it. If we don't know that, then we don't know. We don't see the subtle other things that are happening. That person who had a previous attempt may have had a moment of hopefulness, but that very knowledge that he shared with you, that he had an attempt when he was younger and that he had almost had a second attempt, means you were dealing with somebody who had chronic suicide ideation all his life. And mm-hmm. we work with those people at D.D. Hirsch. We work with attempt survivors who are struggling to stay alive. And we know there is such a thing as a chronic condition, but it's invisible to everybody. And nobody is going to suspect that because you wanted to die years ago, you may want to die again. The thing is, if you wanted to die years ago, my guess is you are still wanting to die, and you've still wanted to die or looked at that as an option all of your life. And then when you hit the crisis and the pain was too much and you couldn't solve the problem, or you couldn't come out of the depression, or you didn't have the treatment and support to find the way or the medication, then you started to tip over, and most likely he began to plan his death a while ago. Now, what we do know, again, is 4 out of 5 times they may have sent us what is known as warning signs, or what we call invitations to help. But unless you're looking for the invitations, they're so subtle. And because suicide is something that doesn't enter our mind to think about, because the abject terror that it strikes that somebody would take their life means we put it off someplace where we don't ever want to think about it. But with the people that have suffered with that suicidal ideation, we need to not only think about it, we need to sit there with them and ask them about it and find out, is this a passing phase, or are you thinking about during this phase that you want to die because you're struggling? And they may say, no, you're crazy or whatever. But if they know that you've made a space, they also may come back to you and say, you know what, I have been and I need help. But we don't go there ever. And I shared with you earlier, I'm a survivor of a suicide loss. And the person I lost, my partner of 15 years, did the same thing. He had a previous attempt in his 20s. He didn't signal me that he was going to die. But at one point he said, I want to die. It's been so bad. But I said, want to die is different than I'm going to die, right? Not really. I want to die was his first invitation to me that I'm thinking about it. Now, I didn't have the other information I have today, that he was dealing with a chronic condition. I didn't know that he was telling me when he said he figured out how to live without this little boy that he lost, this child, that he had decided to die. And so not knowing that he was also giving me those same warning signs, because we're not educated and we can't often guess unless we know about the risk factors that preceded those.
I don't know now if I am just hypersensitive or hypervigilant, but I listen to the way people speak and the things that they say differently now. And I take an extra moment to analyze that. And we don't have a lot of time left, but I do want to ask you a question that I think is really important. We struggle, me and several of my friends that were really close with Will, we struggle that there was no goodbye. There was no note. there was no statement of that. And also, too, you touched something that really piqued my mind, because he was in therapy. And he had shared with me that he had shared these two attempts with his therapist, and he had just seen her.
And she missed it.
She missed it. Mm-hmm. So I hate to say that her misery made me actually feel better, because right. I was like, I'm not trained to see it.
And I'm a clinician as well, and I missed it.
So how do you explain to me, you know, some people do leave a note, some people don't leave a note. Mm-hmm. Is the note necessarily always a note on paper, or is it something, can it be something else?
Yeah, well, first of all, I do want to also say there are a community of survivors. If we know that 60% of us will have been exposed to suicide and 20% of us will have lost someone in the family, it's a traumatic grief that leaves you with exactly that: unfinished business, questions unanswered. And so I always want to also tell survivors, we don't always know, and we weren't always entitled or brought into that world where we can see it. I mean, we train volunteers for 8 weeks for 8 hours a day to ask about suicide, and so I expect a layperson just to do that. There's not always a note. I think what I want to get across always is there are risk factors that if someone has had a previous attempt and they run into a crisis, look out for the warning signs and ask about it. And the warning signs may be really subtle, like, I just want to give up, or I don't feel like going on. And you may think, well, that's, we all feel that sometimes.
I had one suicidal teacher that left a message on my, you know, my answering service: tell Pat I did the best I could.
Exactly.
I sent the paramedics immediately, and I want to stress that. Please do not discount kids when they say, I'm going to kill myself. Don't ever not do something about somebody threatening to kill or hurt themselves. Get somebody who has the power to come and put them in a hospital for a 5150 immediately. Do not play shrink. If
right.
your gut tells you that that is a statement that sounds self-destructive, get somebody to evaluate it medically.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would second that. Absolutely. Because we don't know, and we always want to really be cautious about it. And again, you can call the crisis line if you want to talk to somebody and say, I have this information. They may ask you to put the person on the line to talk to them directly if you don't feel like you can have the courage to do it. But again, the reality is we don't know. So being able to seek treatment, not leave the person alone, or ask the question. We always say we do a two-day seminar on ask the person if they're thinking of killing themselves. Ask the person if suicide has entered their mind. Ask them if they feel like they can't go on and they want to die. Think of ways that you can go. And again, it's not that common. It's 10 out of 100,000 people. But it's common enough that we're losing way too many people, the second leading cause for teenagers especially. So what Dr. Allen said, when somebody says, I want to die or I feel like I can't go on, absolutely call the crisis line. Call, you know, ask them. We ask them other things. Do you have a plan? And most importantly, what you can do to evaluate risk is you can ask their intent. Some people may have the desire to die when it's tough. Some people may even have the capability. But the last quality that we're looking for is an intent. How likely are you to act on those thoughts? Do you have a plan? Have you thought about it? On a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being, no, I'm just having a really bad day. 5 being, no, I'm going to kill myself if I'm left alone. If they say 4 or 5, if they say 3, 4, or 5, they're in trouble. If they say 1 or 2, then you say, I'm going to ask you about it later. But it is a way for us to get a sense. You can have the desire and capability, but if you actually have the intent to die, that's what you want to find out. It's a really wonderful tool for clinicians, physicians, to friends, to evaluate us on the crisis line if somebody's at risk for dying by suicide.
Give me the crisis number one more time.
So again, that number is 1-800-673-TALK.
Thank you. Dr. Allen, we are running out of time, but I want you to tell me what you want to say tonight about our guest and what we've talked about.
We are all gifted with Robert Storr. He's an extraordinarily sensitive professional man who has managed through sad means to get to a place of potency. And I am honored to know him for many, many years, and I have benefited by him on my dark days, and I'm glad that he took care of himself when he suffered through the suicide.
And Robert, what have you got to say before we go?
Oh, well, I can share with you, one, thank you for having me on. And I can share about Dr. Pat Allen that I would not be the man I am today if I had not many, many years ago gone into her office and had her ask me this question: who are the women in your life? Because in order for you to become the man you want to become, you have to be grounded in a good, spiritual, honorable woman. And this is the woman in my life. So a very mutual connection here where it's been wonderful. And thank you for sharing your pain and allowing us to provide an opportunity of hope and help for those people who may need that tonight.
Thank you. Everyone, I want to thank you for tuning in with us tonight. This is an issue that is very close to my heart and is really important to me, as it is to Robert and Dr. Allen. And I want to say, don't be ashamed. There's no shame in it. Reach out and seek help. We're here and we're not judging. Please dial the number that Robert has if you know somebody or if you are in pain and suffering. Search it on the internet, Google it, surf it, find it. Follow us on Facebook, find us at www.drpatallen.com. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to On the Air with Dr. Pat Allen, Empowered Communication, right here on LA Talk Radio.